Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tonight at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa, there will be a commemoration of the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. It was November 9, 1938, which marked the beginnings of 2 days of vandalism, acts of arson, assault, and murder. Over 250 synagogues burned, 7,000 Jewish businesses vandalized and looted, dozens murdered, while German police and firemen stepped aside. In a matter of days, over 30,000 German Jews were sent to concentration camps, and Kristallnacht today is often viewed as the beginning of the Holocaust. In remembrance of this, the Tulsa Council for Holocaust Education will present a program tonight at 7 o'clock at the Sylvan Auditorium of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. That's located at 2021 East 71st Street. The event will feature a reading of Catherine Pressman Taylor's 1938 novella of letters titled Address Unknown, one of the first anti-Nazi pieces of literature written. My guest today will present a recounting of Hitler's rise and the events of Kristallnacht as a part of the program as well. Dr. Joseph Bradley is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa and a member of the Council for Holocaust Education, and he joins us to talk about the events leading up to and that occurred during Kristallnacht. Joseph Bradley is my guest today. Joseph Bradley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, and I think most people sort of date this to the beginning of the Holocaust. How did Kristallnacht occur? Why did it occur? Because the Nazis had been in power for several years, and in fact had already put Jewish codes into effect throughout Germany and were denying Jewish intellectuals their work positions and government positions. So the repression was already on. What happened to cause Kristallnacht?
Well, you're right. Definitely beginning in 1933, the Nazis had already instituted a series of discriminatory measures against the Jews. I think that it happened in 1938 for several reasons. There had been a tension or disagreement in the Nazi Party, which was a large and rather complex movement, between those who wanted to continue to focus on quote-unquote legal methods of discrimination and many younger activists, and in particular the what were called the stormtroopers, who were more interested in violence and sort of physical punishment and going after Jews physically. And for a long time, since 1933, the former had prevailed. There was more emphasis on legal discrimination. But there had been brief spurts of violence. In 1933, right after Hitler came to power, there was a fair amount of sort of street violence. Again in 1935, there were outbreaks, kind of random violence in the summer of 1935. But then nothing really major until 1938. So one reason is the prevalence of this, of the idea of legal discrimination. Another reason why I think there wasn't more physical violent outbreaks until 1938 is that, and it may seem rather odd to hear this today, but Hitler actually was concerned with foreign public opinion.
We had the Olympics in 36.
In the Olympics in 1936.
Actually, both Olympics, yes. In 36. Yes. The winter was also in Germany.
Yes, both Olympics.
And if he had done too much, it could have possibly been taken away, or at least nations would have boycotted, and it would have been the public relations bonanza that those events end up being.
Exactly. Hitler was interested in, or he was sensitive to foreign public opinion. He did not want Germany to be perceived, both at home and abroad, as a lawless country. And so I think for that reason, whenever there were outbursts of physical violence, they were fairly short-lasting. They didn't last too long because Hitler wanted to kind of put the lid on. But after the Olympics were over, I'd say beginning in late 1936, 1937, the Nazis began to plan for war. And I think in this context, they'd already started to violate the Versailles Treaty. They'd moved into a demilitarized zone around the Rhine River called Rhineland in 1936. They'd started a rearmament program. So they were already preparing for war. So I think in this context, foreign public opinion, it still mattered, but not nearly as much.
The Rhineland occurred also, the Anschutz,
yes,
between
right.
Austria and Germany at
right.
this point.
And that was in March 1938. The Nazis took over Austria. And in the fall of 1938, and this gets us a little bit closer to Kristallnacht, there was a lot of tension over the part of Czechoslovakia called the Sudetenland, which is an area where a lot of ethnic Germans lived. And the Nazis took over the Sudetenland in the fall of 1938. Another dimension is that the goal of the Nazis was, or the hope of the Nazis is that Jews would leave Germany. Their hope was that if, because of these various discriminatory practices from 1933 on, they hoped that Jews would realize that there was not a future for them in Germany and that they would leave.
Now, was the immigration policy, you know, everything I know of, that it was very difficult to get out of Germany at
yes,
some point, but was it easier earlier?
It was easier earlier. Certainly it was easier earlier than it became in 1939. Once the Second World War started, that door was basically closed. And it was definitely closed for Jews who were in Eastern Europe, who had not been in Germany before. But the Nazis wanted the Jews to leave Germany. But what was happening is that although there were departures, some 150,000 out of the Jewish population in Nazi Germany in 1933, when Hitler came to power, was under 500,000. It was less than 1% of the country. It was by no means a very large population. What was happening is that although Jews were leaving, in spite of the difficulties, and you're right, there were the Nazis themselves. I mean, in a sense, their policies were contradictory.
Well, in fact, they would try to extract as much wealth as they could you were leaving, too, yeah.
That was one difficulty. They made it very difficult for Jews to leave, even though supposedly they wanted them to. They didn't want them to take a lot of money with them. The other difficulty, of course, is on the receiving side. Countries in Europe and the United States
did not want them.
Had immigration
quotas.
Yeah. So it was... But nevertheless, some 100,000-150,000 Jews managed to leave before 1938. This, in the Nazis' eyes, though, this was still not enough. Not enough Jews were leaving, and not fast enough. So after the takeover of Austria, during 1938, the Nazis stepped up their discriminatory policies. And there was some sporadic violence in the summer of 1938. There was some synagogues which were burned. There was a magazine called Der Stürmer, which was viciously anti-Semitic. And one of their issues in July, one of the features, was entitled Synagogues Are Robbers' Dens. So there were a couple of outbreaks of violence already in the summer of 1938. And the acquisition of Austria, because there are some 200,000 Jews living in Austria, most of them concentrated in Vienna, that canceled out the number of Jews who had emigrated already from Germany between 33 and 38.
So was there a rethinking of, you mentioned this divide between younger
yes.
Nazis and
right.
More established Nazis
right.
in the hierarchy, and all of a sudden the equation changes.
The equation changes, at least in the short run. The equation changes in the summer and fall of 1938, and it tilts toward let's try violence. Then what happens in October of 1938? There were some 50,000 Jews of Polish origin who were living in Germany. Many of them had come to Germany even before 1914. Or shortly after World War I, looking for better opportunities. They'd already built families in Germany.
So when they've been here 20, 30 years, they would almost consider themselves German?
They would. Well, most German Jews considered themselves German.
No, I meant Polish Jews.
Yes,
Polish Jews.
Yes, they would. Particularly if children had been born in Germany, yes, they would consider themselves Germans, but the Nazis didn't. They
right.
still consider themselves Jews. So the order went out in the fall of 1938 to expel these 50,000 Polish Jews. And at the end of October 38, without warning, about 17,000 Polish Jews were rounded up and taken to the and dumped in the Polish border. The Poles didn't want to admit them, so they were in limbo.
They're basically stranded at the border?
They were stranded at the border. They were living in refugee camps. And one of these families wrote a letter to their son, who at that time was living in Paris. He was a student in Paris. His name was Herschel Greenspan. He got a letter from his family describing the deplorable conditions that, you know, they'd been given 48 hours to leave. They were taken off in carts and trains and dumped in this refugee camp.
Very much what would be the story of the Holocaust at some point.
In a way, it's a kind of prefiguring of what's later going to happen on a much greater scale. So anyway, Herschel Greenspan gets this letter, and he feels so outraged. He buys a pistol, goes to the German embassy in Paris, and shoots the third secretary at the German embassy on November 7th, 1938. And 2 days later, this man dies. Ernst von Rath is his name. He dies on November 9th. The reaction is immediate. On November 7th and November 8th, there were a series of violent outbreaks, destruction of synagogues, trashing of Jewish stores, scattered around Germany. But then what happens is a very interesting coincidence, and I'm going to mention this in my talk. November 9th was a very important date in the Nazi Party calendar because it marked the anniversary of what's called the Beer Hall Putsch.
All right, in 1923,
the very youthful Nazi Party and its still inexperienced leader, Adolf Hitler, tried to take over the local government in Munich. And this Beer Hall Putsch, because that's where some of the government, I guess, was meeting or something like that, it was put down. And, 16 or 17 Nazis were killed, and Hitler was arrested and served a year in prison. Actually, a little bit less than a year, but he was imprisoned. And, of course, in prison is when he wrote Mein Kampf. Right. So ever since November 9th, 1923, that night had been an important anniversary for the Nazi Party.
So this would have been typical by marching through
they
the
would,
streets?
They would have some of their marches. They would get together for speeches, kind of rallies. The Nazi leadership would be involved. The stormtroopers would be out. They would go through rituals. There was something called the Blood Flag, which was the flag that they were carrying in the 1923 demonstration against the Munich government. So that Blood Flag was a part of these rituals ever since. It was a night when new members of the SS would go through a recruiting ritual. So on the night of November 9th, 1938... The leadership is kind of in place.
Right.
They're there. They're ready to go. They're already listening to rather incendiary speeches. And they have this sort of moment. It's kind of almost like it's in their laps. And the minister of propaganda, his name is Joseph Goebbels, he suggests to Hitler, this would be a good time to unleash the rage that the German people have, that
they had fomented in
yes,
the first place.
Yes, that's right. The revenge that they want to exercise against the Jews. So then on the night of November 9th, November 10th, the Nazis issue an order to the police and the fire departments to kind of...
Take the night off.
Let the boys have some fun. Don't stop them. Unless it might be destroying Aryan property, non-Jewish property. And that's the night when you have, and this is in all over Germany. It's not sporadic. It's not isolated in just a few towns. It's everywhere. Yeah. And that's the night that some 7,000 businesses are trashed. Synagogues, 300 or 400 synagogues are destroyed. And it's because of this destruction, and in particular because of the breaking of so many store windows, that it came to be called the Night of Broken Glass, or Kristallnacht.
My guest today is Joseph Bradley, professor of history at the University of Tulsa. He'll be part of the 75th anniversary commemoration of Kristallnacht, which will take place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. The actual 75th anniversary was back in November 9th, but the commemoration will be taking place tonight at the Sylvan Auditorium. And, of course, many Jewish civilians were killed that evening. Thousands of businesses, homes ransacked, synagogues burned. And then the next day, like you mentioned, the Polish native Jews that were returned to Poland, the next day, German Jews are rounded up and sent to concentration camps.
Yes, over the next few days after Kristallnacht, some 25, 30,000 Jews were rounded up and sent to concentration camps.
This is really the beginning of the Holocaust, because the concentration camps,
yes,
there were Jews there, but it was mainly political enemies, communists, labor unions, homosexuals, anybody, communists for the most part.
Right.
These were enemies of the regime, political enemies of the regime.
Right. Yeah, the first people that the Nazis went after in 1933 were the communists and the socialists. And there certainly were Jews in the concentration camps, but this is really 1938 is the first kind of large-scale roundup of people, not because they were political enemies or because they were members, simply because they were Jewish. Many of these people who were rounded up right after Kristallnacht were eventually released under the promise that they would leave Germany, or that they would show evidence that they were trying to leave. So not all of this, let's say this batch of this cohort of 30,000, not all of them stayed in the concentration camps at that moment, because then in the next year or so, another 100,000 or so Jews did manage to leave Nazi Germany. But again, you know, so what are the Nazis thinking? Here's a country that wants to rid itself of Jews. It invades Poland in September 1939, conquers Poland, and immediately acquires 3 million more Jews. And it's really, I think, at this point, I mean, certainly Kristallnacht is a kind of foreshadowing and the kind of the severe persecution just before and just after, a kind of flurry of additional discriminatory measures, including not allowing Jews to have driver's licenses. I mean, that level of. But it's really not, I think, till the Second World War begins, when Germany suddenly, when it invades Poland, and then 2 years later when it invades the Soviet Union, suddenly acquires a huge Jewish population, that then I think they begin thinking of what we now call the final solution. I think their measures really before were very kind of ad hoc. I don't think they knew exactly what to do or how to do it. They wanted to rid Germany of Jewish influence, but exactly how to do that and the timing of it, I think, was kind of trial and error.
And I think for people who come at this from the outside, a lot of times they say, why would these Jewish families stay in their homeland when they're experiencing such discrimination? Of course, the Jewish population in Europe had always undergone pogroms over the years, and these times had occurred and passed. And I think Kristallnacht was the beginning of a realization this was something completely different and perhaps not the average discrimination or even extraordinary discrimination against the Jewish population that occurred in Europe previous.
Right. No, I think this was a moment when a kind of the physical danger of Jews in Germany was now apparent. I think that again, the violence that came seemingly out of nowhere on the night of November 9th, Kristallnacht, was shut off fairly quickly. Hitler still, I think, did not like the idea of kind of pogrom hooligan violence, even though he, in much of his incendiary rhetoric, you could certainly say he encouraged it. and encouraged it among the stormtroopers. But I think he still didn't feel that this was the best way to go, as far as removing the Jews. And the alternative was a much more planned and kind of centralized and coordinated effort to get Jews to leave. And the model for this was the persecution of Jews in Vienna in the spring of 1938, after the Anschluss, after Austria became part of Germany. And the architect of this much more sort of bureaucratic way of persecuting the Jews was Adolf Eichmann. And in a way, that became more the model for dealing with the Jewish population than the kind of explosive violence of Kristallnacht. But certainly Kristallnacht, I think, made people fear the physical danger that they experienced.
Now, for this commemoration tonight at the Jewish Federation, you'll be sharing, I guess, the background story of Kristallnacht, and what else will be going on?
Well, I will talk very briefly at the very beginning and give kind of a background of Kristallnacht and sort of Nazi persecution of the Jews. Then the bulk of the evening is going to be a dramatic reading of a fictionalized correspondence, letters, and the title of this kind of novel is Address Unknown. And it's a fictionalized correspondence. It was written actually in the late 1930s, so it's quite contemporary. It's a correspondence between two friends and business associates who in the early 1930s come to America, and one of them is Jewish and one of them is non-Jewish, German. And the German goes back to Germany, and then they have this correspondence between America and Germany. And initially, the Jew who stays behind in the United States, he's kind of curious, you know, I heard about this Hitler guy, what's going on? And initially, the Germans, I'm not sure, he says, you know, he seems like, you know, he might be a good leader. But progressively, over the next couple of years of this correspondence, the German more and more kind of mouths the Nazi ideals, the Nazi propaganda, you know, Hitler is a strong leader and so on and so forth. So it kind of shows the deterioration in this, just in these exchange of letters, the deterioration in both their personal and business relationship.
You see the poison seeping in through this incessant propaganda.
Yes, right. And two local Tulsa actors will be sort of reading the parts of these in this correspondence.
And that'll be Randy Whalen and David Verrilli. And that'll be a part of the commemoration
yes,
tonight.
Yes, that will be really the sort of the main act of the commemoration event.
Let me ask you a question. Kristallnacht is now 75 years ago. What are the lessons we need to keep in mind from this event and you know, the vigilance against ethnic discrimination, but beyond that, what do we need to keep in mind about Kristallnacht?
Well, I think it shows us where the politics of hate can go. That words can have consequences, especially given the right circumstances or the right timing or the right almost accidental events that might come along. That words have consequences, and the ethnic hatred or hatred of any kind is something that we continually have to be on guard against. And I think it also, and there's one very striking quotation. I have several eyewitness accounts of Kristallnacht, and I'll read a selection from a couple of them. But there's a woman in a small German town, and her husband's shop is trashed, and I think their home above is also trashed. And she sees that some neighbors are around and kind of, you know, looking and maybe even plundering a little bit. And she says, "Why do you torment us? How have we wronged you?" And I think what Kristallnacht shows is the very sort of precarious nature of the difference between right and wrong. And we as human beings always have to kind of keep in mind and keep sort of at front and center this difference between right and wrong. And I think what happened far too much in the 1930s, and certainly on the night of Kristallnacht, is too many people lost that sense of difference between right and wrong.
And whether it's turning a blind eye or becoming a participant.
Exactly, right.
I think that's the most interesting thing is that, you know, in a small town, in a big city, there's anonymity, but in a small town where you know the neighbors, the people who come into the store, and all of a sudden they're ransacking your business, going through your house,
right,
tearing your house apart, threatening you with physical violence. It's a terroristic event.
Right. And I think that's one reason, I think, why the Nazi leadership, even on the whole, if it didn't really approve of this kind of, or didn't want to have this sort of lawless kind of violence, but at certain moments it might be useful, because what was happening is that before 1938, there still were Jewish businesses, and in the Nazi eyes, far too many Germans were still doing business with Jews, and the Nazis didn't want that to happen. I don't think that the average German at heart wanted to go after Jews or be cruel to them. But there's probably a latent resentment of Jews, or a latent kind of certainly a perception that they were different. The Jews traditionally are the outsider in Europe. And when there's an opportunity, you know, when maybe someone's apartment is being trashed, or there's an opportunity to participate in this, or there's an opportunity to get something for yourself, there's an opportunity to kind of take revenge, even if it's perhaps someone that you might, whose store you might go to, then that's, I think, is when it becomes very difficult for people to sort of see that barrier between what's right and wrong, and to stop short of doing the violent things that they did.
Yeah. Well, it's an ugly incident in world history, and it's good that we remember it. The 75th anniversary commemoration of Kristallnacht takes place tonight at the Jewish Federation of Tulsa at the Sylvan Auditorium, where my guest, Joseph Bradley, will give a background on Kristallnacht, and of course there'll be the reading of Catherine Pressman Taylor's novella, Address Unknown. Joseph, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Joseph Bradley is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa and a member of the Council for Holocaust Education, which is presenting a remembrance of the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. That event takes place this evening at 7 o'clock at the Sylvan Auditorium, the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. That's located at 2021 East 71st Street. The program is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa, and you can look through our archives for past programs and listen to some of our more recent ones as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.